You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 117, Impossible. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters for making all this possible. On our most recent bonus episode, I asked the subscribers for their opinions on the future direction of the show. I have not yet made any decisions, so there's still plenty of time for you to sign up, listen, and weigh in yourself. And of course, you'll also get access to over 2 years' worth of bonus content and ad-free versions of the regular episodes, all for just $2 a month. Visit patreon.com/ageofnapoleon to sign up. Anyway, we left off last time in late November 1808. The second French invasion of Spain had been going on for about a month, this time led by the Emperor himself, and including many of the best veteran units of the Grande Armée. They had already achieved considerable successes. 4 Spanish field armies had been defeated in major battles. French forces had taken the first objective of Napoleon's plan, the city of Burgos, which became the Emperor's headquarters. Not everything had gone according to plan. There had been miscues, and even a few setbacks. But we've covered a lot of campaigns on this show. How often do any of them go exactly according to plan? Still, Napoleon was not happy with his subordinates. As you might recall from last episode, he had just issued Marshal Victor an official reprimand, and fired Marshal Bessières. He was also unhappy with the results of the Battle of Tudela, which we discussed at the end of last episode, where the two bickering patriot generals, Francisco Castaños and José de Palafox, had been unable to concentrate their forces, and had been soundly defeated by Marshal Lannes. Tudela had been a clear French victory, but Napoleon had been hoping for something more. This was supposed to be an envelopment battle, with Marshal Ney and his 6th Corps marching around the Spanish flank to cut off their retreat and destroy both Patriot armies. The way things had worked out, only about half the Spanish force had actually been engaged, and Marshal Ney hadn't even been close to the Spanish rear by the time the battle ended. And so, although Tudela was a terrific blow to the Patriot cause, both Spanish armies had been able to retreat from the battlefield, with a significant number of their units still intact. And so, although Tudela had been a lopsided French victory, the Emperor considered it a failure. He blamed Marshal Ney for moving too slowly. Ney was one of the most aggressive and charismatic leaders in the army. He always pressed the attack to a fault, and he was famous for his ability to get that last bit of extra effort from his soldiers. Most historians blame the poor Spanish infrastructure, rough terrain, and the exhaustion of 6th Corps, rather than any timidness on the part of Marshal Ney. But, as we discussed last episode, the failures of the French leadership in the opening phase of this war had put Napoleon on alert. He felt he needed to whip his marshals and generals into shape. Up to this point, the marshals had taken the lead in tactical command. Bonaparte had been content to exercise his authority from afar. That was about to change. His plan was about to enter its second phase. French victories in early and mid-November had brushed aside the main Spanish field armies, and now the way was clear for a thrust towards Madrid, the capital and main transportation and economic hub of the country. The Emperor would lead this attack personally. Before launching this campaign, Bonaparte had written to his brother Louis, saying he hoped to have things wrapped up before the new year. The idea of completing a campaign like this, over a huge area with mostly bad infrastructure and lots of rough terrain, opposed by multiple enemy armies, in less than 2 months, was quite ambitious, maybe to the point of hubris. But by this point, the French did seem to be on track to keep that timetable. All the major Spanish field armies had been badly defeated. 2 had been practically destroyed. The only force of any significant size that remained to oppose the French was the small British army under General Sir John Moore, and they were still mired in their difficult march through central Iberia, and nowhere close to the action. The way was open to Madrid. Well, almost. There was still one remaining hurdle for the advancing French, the Sierra de Guadarrama, a rugged mountain range that separates Madrid from the north of the country. There were only a small handful of narrow passes through which the French might cross the mountains and make their final drive on the capital. A narrow mountain pass is maybe the most effective natural defensive position on Earth, the type of position that can be an equalizer, allowing smaller or inferior armies to punch above their weight and take on larger or better quality enemies. The most famous example in Western history is certainly the Pass at Thermopylae, defended by the semi-legendary 300 Spartans under King Leonidas, a story which I would guess almost all the officers on both sides knew. These were places where a few thousand poorly trained militia might stand a chance of holding off one of the greatest armies ever assembled. Even with their field armies battered and scattered, the terrain gave the Spanish one last chance to defend their capital. In past episodes, we've seen the Spanish achieve incredible things through sheer zeal and determination. Maybe their country's rough terrain had created the conditions for another miracle. The Patriots pulled together every soldier they could muster. Troops were pulled away from garrison duty, militias were called up, and desperate calls for fresh volunteers echoed across central Spain. All told, they managed to pull together perhaps as many as 20,000 men, a pretty impressive feat under the circumstances. Assuming that high estimate is somewhere close to correct, this was almost the size of those field armies we discussed last episode. However, the quality of these units was generally extremely bad, even by the standards of the Spanish military in 1808. A large number of the men were newly raised for this battle from the city of Madrid. They went straight to the mountains after joining up. There was no time for even the most basic training. They would be led by General Benito de San Juan, an aristocrat and former officer of the old Royal Army. San Juan was 81 years old, but he had joined the army late in life and only had limited military experience. On top of that, he was a former crony of the hated ex-prime minister Manuel Godoy. He had languished at junior ranks before he caught the eye of the sausage maker. To be blunt, San Juan did not seem like the ideal candidate to face off against Bonaparte, more like a retread of the aging, incompetent Austrian generals Napoleon had obliterated early in his career. However, as we've seen in past episodes, the Spanish had a hard time finding capable, politically acceptable commanders, and so San Juan would have to do. One advantage the Patriots did have was a decent artillery arm. As we saw during the Dos de Mayo uprising, the Spanish military had stored a lot of its artillery in Madrid. Many of those guns had been sent to the front, but there were enough left over to provide this new, improvised force with something approaching proper artillery support. Somewhere between 16 and 22 cannons, depending on what source you believe. And their crews were trained regulars. San Juan brought his motley force into the Sierra de Guadarrama and placed detachments at all the passes. He deployed the vast majority of his force at a place called Somosierra. He couldn't be sure which route the French would use, but this would be the most logical, and indeed, it's exactly what Napoleon was planning. The emperor left Burgos with about 45,000 men. They were among the best the French army had to offer. Marshal Victor's First Corps, mostly composed of veteran French units, plus a significant part of the Imperial Guard. Bonaparte would have a numerical advantage of more than 2-1. On paper, the two opposing forces were nowhere close to matched. The Spanish would be relying almost entirely on the terrain to even the odds. Fortunately for the Patriots, Somosierra was an incredibly formidable position, even by the standards of mountain passes. The Sierra de Guadarrama are really jagged, rocky mountains, lots of sheer cliffs and dramatic bare slopes that are too steep to climb. The pass itself is very narrow, in places only about 6 meters or 20 feet across. There was no room to maneuver, and no easy or obvious way to flank the position. The only way to the other side was straight through. Within the pass, numbers wouldn't matter. At absolute maximum, only a handful of men could engage at any given moment. If Napoleon and the cream of the Grande Armée could be stopped by an improvised army of mostly militia, it would be at a place like this. General San Juan prepared the position well. He stationed most of his infantry in the mountains on either side of the pass, where they would be able to fire down on the French if they attempted to force the pass itself, or hold off any French infantry who might try to climb the mountains to outflank the position. Inside the pass, he stationed a few more infantry, plus all of the artillery. The troops within the pass were arranged in four successive defensive positions, each centered on a battery of between 2 and 10 cannon. They also dug some entrenchments, although they didn't have much time and were not trained in the art of building fortifications, so these were pretty rudimentary. If the French hoped to take this position, they would have to either somehow climb those steep mountains under fire from the Spanish infantry on the heights, or force their way through all four of the defensive positions inside the pass, charging into the mouths of the guns four times, while taking fire from the Spanish infantry on both flanks. A French officer would later describe the position, quote, "Such a fortress, crafted by nature and human hand, seemed to be impregnable," end quote. Despite the poor quality of the Patriot forces, the conditions were right for a bloodbath. The French arrived on the far side of the pass on November 29, 1808. Their vanguard found a small detachment of Spanish militia on the far side of the pass and attacked immediately. They were probably surprised when the Patriots held firm. The French were pushed back. Napoleon sent in reinforcements from the Imperial Guard, and the position was quickly taken. But once again, the French had underestimated their enemies. Bonaparte ordered a platoon of the Imperial Guard to ride towards Somosierra and bring back a prisoner. From their limited vantage point, it was hard to say what awaited the French inside the pass. Their task would be much easier if they had a first-hand account of the Spanish defenses. A few hours later, the horsemen rode back with a hapless Spanish militiaman in tow. He was brought before Bonaparte and the army staff, and they decided to get him drunk to loosen his tongue, which apparently worked. As the Spaniard told his tale, one of the troopers who had captured him began to elbow his way forward, through the crowd of officers and aides around the Emperor's campfire. He had an unlit pipe in his mouth, and clearly wanted to borrow a bit of flame from the fire. This was a bold move, maybe even a bit rude. Some of the officers tried to stop him, but Napoleon waved them off, allowing the trooper to light his tobacco. He puffed away on the pipe, saying nothing, and making no acknowledgement of the small favor the Emperor had just done him. One of his officers was aghast at this disrespect, and scolded the man, quote, "You might at least thank His Majesty for the privilege," end quote. The trooper replied, quote, "What good would that do here?" end quote. He then gestured towards the Spanish positions and continued, quote, "I'll thank him up there," end quote. He had a point. Members of the Imperial Guard were always allowed a certain degree of latitude in their behavior, in recognition of their fighting qualities. Surely the next day, up on those heights, many members of the Guard would prove they deserved those privileges. I think there might have been something else going on here, too. This soldier and his officer came from a relatively new unit, the 1st Polish Light Cavalry of the Imperial Guard, formed less than 2 years earlier. They were ideological soldiers. Many of the officers of the regiment had been drawn from the membership of an organization known as the Society of the Friends of the Fatherland, which had operated as a revolutionary patriotic secret society during the foreign occupation of Poland. not unlike the Sons of Liberty of the American Revolution. Some of the regiment's men had seen combat as insurgents during the Greater Poland Uprising, or had fought alongside the French in other Polish units in French service, before being reassigned to this new regiment. But most of them were fresh recruits, who had joined up in a fit of patriotic fervor after the French liberated their country. They may have been inexperienced, but they were highly motivated, eager to show their admiration and gratitude to Napoleon, who they viewed as their country's savior, and to prove that despite their country's misfortunes in the preceding decades, Poland had a right to stand tall among the nations of Europe. Every unit of the Imperial Guard was eager to prove its mettle in combat. The soldiers of Napoleon's empire were generally competitive and took the reputations of their regiments seriously. But in late 1808, there was perhaps no unit in the Emperor's service hungrier for glory than the 1st Polish Light Cavalry of the Imperial Guard. I think that trooper was probably far from alone in hoping that the next day, November 30th, would be the first chapter in a glorious history for the regiment. At this stage, only the vanguard of Napoleon's force had arrived outside Somosierra. The next day, the Emperor would wait for the rest of his troops to arrive, then press the attack. November 30th, 1808 would prove to be a dark day, in the literal sense. The sun rises late in central Spain this time of year. It was overcast, and a thick fog clung to the ground. French troops rose early and made their final march to the battlefield in the dark. The French would start the day by attacking the heights on either side of the pass. These were incredibly tough positions, but if they could make at least some progress, forcing the pass would become a little easier. The terrain here was far too rough to attack in a proper formation. The troops would have to climb and navigate obstacles as they advanced, and would need to use all the natural cover if they hoped to survive the concentrated fire from above. Only a loose skirmish formation would do. This was a job for the light infantry, the famous voltigeurs of the Grande Armée. Bonaparte assembled the light infantry companies of every available regiment and ordered them to attack the heights. The thick fog favored the attackers, but even so, this was a daunting mission. The voltigeurs crept forward through the mist. Visibility was down to about 50 paces, and so the two sides were very close when they began to open fire. The French light infantry were some of the best in the world. Despite the incredibly difficult terrain, the voltigeurs gave as good as they got. The patriots took casualties, but held firm. The French attack stalled, devolving into a firefight, where the Spanish held the advantage. Napoleon sent in another wave of light infantry to bolster the attack, but it made little impression. The hours wore on, and nothing changed. Voltigeurs and patriot militia kept sniping at each other among the rocks and hills at the foot of the mountains, but they were locked in a stalemate. An assault column was formed up, just waiting for the order to charge the pass, but Bonaparte would not order them forward without first making some kind of dent in the Spanish defenses. Rushing headlong into the enemy batteries within the pass, with the heights on both sides still controlled by the patriots, would lead to unacceptable casualties, and might not prove successful. By now it was nearing noon. That morning fog was finally beginning to burn off, although around the Spanish position it had been replaced by gunpowder smoke. As great generals do, Napoleon got creative and began looking for alternatives. With his army's massive superiority in both numbers and quality, all he needed was one crack in the enemy position for his troops to exploit. With the voltigeurs making no progress along the flanks of the Spanish position, the most logical next step was to try to somehow chip away at the center, the defenses around the pass itself. That was not an easy proposition, but studying the patriot position with his artilleryman's eye, Bonaparte thought he saw a flaw in the Spanish defenses that might represent an opportunity. The first Spanish artillery battery in the center was quite far forward, really more in front of the opening of the pass than inside it. It did not have very much infantry support. The Spanish were clearly banking on the musket fire from the heights on either side to cover the gunners while they reloaded their cannon. But the battery was so far forward that might not have been possible. If they handled themselves well, a fast-moving unit of cavalry could seize the battery before the Spanish firepower had a chance to overwhelm them. Napoleon called forward one of his cavalry commanders, General Hippolyte Piret, and told him to take a small unit of cavalry up close to the battery to see if this idea was feasible. Piret and his men trotted towards the battery and soon came under withering fire. As I mentioned earlier in this episode, the Spanish gun crews were no amateurs. Piret galloped back to headquarters, saying, quote, "It's impossible," end quote. Bonaparte retorted, quote, "Impossible? I don't know the meaning of the word," end quote. He was so annoyed that, according to one source, he flicked his riding crop at General Piret, who had to lurch backwards to avoid being struck. One of the generals of the Imperial Guard, Frédéric-Henri Walter, tried to reason with the Emperor, telling him the Voltigeurs were advancing on both flanks. They just needed more time to push back the Spanish and navigate the ascent up the heights. All of the aides on the Emperor's staff seemed to agree. But it was no use. That comment from General Piret that the charge was impossible seems to have really gotten under Napoleon's skin. He was agitated, and seems not to have heard Walter's argument, continuing, quote, "Impossible. What? My guard stopped by peasants? By armed bands?" End quote. As I've mentioned in past episodes, Napoleon had real contempt for the Spanish. He considered the whole country backwards, and had particular disrespect for their military. I think this is why he was so agitated. He was insulted by the idea that any position, manned by what he considered a mob of country bumpkins, could be too formidable for his troops. He summoned an officer. Sources differ who. It was either Marshal Berthier, his chief of staff, or General Louis-Pierre Montbrun, commander of the Guard's cavalry. Whoever it was, he told them to order 3rd Squadron of the Polish Light Cavalry of the Imperial Guard to take that Spanish battery. Whoever he was, the officer registered his objections, but the Emperor insisted, and the order was relayed. Many of the troopers of this squadron had been praying for an order like this one, a chance to show what they were made of, to make their country proud, and show their gratitude to the man they saw as their liberator. After receiving the orders, an officer called out, quote, "Light cavalry to the trot," end quote, and the regiment stirred to life. The voice of squadron leader Jan Kosciutowski rang out, quote, "Form fours," end quote. That meant to form an attack column 4 troopers wide. This was a very narrow formation, but the pass itself was quite narrow, and besides, they would be coming under heavy fire. It would do them well to only present a small target to the enemy gunners. Napoleon rode out to watch 3rd Squadron go into action. The troopers raised their sabers in a salute, crying out, "Long live the Emperor!" The Emperor returned their salute and shouted back, quote, "Poles, take me those cannon!" End quote. One of the greatest cavalry charges in history had just begun. Sources differ as to how many men were riding out on this mission, but every reliable account agrees it was not very many. The last cavalry charge I called one of the greatest in history was Marshal Murat's attack at the Battle of Eylau, which may have included as many as 10,000 troopers. This would be nothing approaching that scale. The attack would be carried out by a single squadron, the 3rd to be precise, possibly joined by a small number of men from other squadrons. They probably numbered about 125, possibly 150, but certainly not more than 200. Other estimates put the number much lower, possibly as few as 80, but the most reliable accounts seem to agree there were somewhere between 100 and 150. As the squadron approached the Spanish battery, one of the officers let loose a war cry. Sources differ as to what he actually said. Some claim it was simply, quote, "Forward, long live the Emperor," end quote. Others claim it was something slightly more colorful, quote, "Forward, you sons of bitches, the Emperor is watching," end quote. Then the Spanish infantry opened fire, and the Poles suffered their first casualties of the day. However, the narrow column formation gave some measure of protection to those in the middle and rear. When the horsemen were about 350 meters, or 380 yards, from the battery, the Patriot artillery opened up with canister fire. The front ranks of the column were devastated, and the charge began to falter. The formation broke down. Some men lost control of their horses. One of the squadron's sergeants would later remember, quote, "I must admit that this deadly salute from the Spaniards threw us into some confusion, and we were wondering how to restore the ranks and try again, when the firm voice of Kosciuszko rang out again." End quote. Steadied by their officers, the confusion passed. Within only 1 or 2 minutes, 3rd Squadron was trotting forward again. Seeing the limited effect this salvo had on their enemy, the Spanish gunners reloaded with traditional solid shot. Canister fire could be incredibly deadly, but it was designed to scatter the damage widely. It was not ideal for penetrating a deep, narrow formation, but a properly placed cannonball could tear through multiple ranks of soldiers. Unfortunately for the Poles, they were not able to close the distance before the Patriot gunners could reload. The cannonballs tore bloody holes through the Polish column, and the infantry were still firing with their muskets. Faced with this storm of firepower, the Poles wavered again. Some in the back ranks momentarily dismounted, so they would provide smaller targets to the enemy. Squadron leader Kosciuszko would later recall, quote, "It is hard to describe the terrible position we were in. I saw men and horses brought down in rows. The first platoon was thrown into disorder. We all shouted, 'Forward, brothers, to the guns!' and 'Long live the Emperor! Forward! Long live the Emperor!'" End quote. The squadron rallied again, and the charge continued. By now they were galloping. The target was close. They easily wheeled around the Spanish entrenchments and charged into the battery, sabers in hand. Many of the Patriot militia scattered immediately. They were untrained, inexperienced, and it was clear the Poles meant business. However, many of the gunners stood and fought. This was somewhat unusual. When an artillery battery was overwhelmed, Napoleonic-era crews typically took cover and waited for an opportunity to return to their guns. As we've discussed already in this episode, the Poles had a lot to fight for. But let's not forget, so did the Spanish. Most of these men believed they were on a holy crusade to save their country from darkness and tyranny. Neither side was going to give in easily. There was bitter hand-to-hand fighting, but now the tables had turned. Mounted cavalry had a huge advantage over dismounted troops in hand-to-hand combat. After seeing so many of their comrades torn apart by artillery fire, the Poles were not interested in taking prisoners. The Spanish gunners and the few militiamen who stayed to fight were killed to the last man. General Piret had said it was impossible to take the battery in a cavalry charge, but the Poles had done it. It was an incredible achievement. The men of the 1st Polish Light Cavalry had woken up that morning hoping to make their regiment's reputation. They had certainly done so. But something even more extraordinary was about to happen. As I mentioned earlier, the Spanish defenses inside the pass were arranged in 4 echelons, each centered on an artillery battery. The Spanish gunners had prepared their defenses well. Each position was within artillery range of the previous position. So, the second the Poles took the battery, they began taking fire from the second battery. The Polish officers rallied their men once again and prepared to charge the second battery. Ever since this day, people have debated how they came to this decision. It seems likely that Napoleon only intended to order them to take the first battery. Remember, this was a mission that a veteran French general had described as impossible. Bonaparte didn't flinch from ordering his troops to make sacrifices. But ordering a single, relatively inexperienced cavalry squadron to make 2 impossible attacks in immediate succession would have been reckless. But their orders had been very vague. There is some confusion as to who actually delivered the command, but all sources agree there had been no written instructions. only a vague oral command. It's possible the Polish officers misunderstood. But what I think is the likeliest explanation is that as the unit came under fire from that second battery, it dawned on the Polish officers that they could not stay stationary and hold the position they had just taken. Sitting still would be tantamount to just waiting to be torn apart by the Spanish artillery. The only two options were to either retreat and give up the gains they had just made at the cost of so many lives, or to continue the attack and silence those guns the hard way. These were bold young men, on fire with patriotism. They felt they had a lot to prove. To them, the choice would have been obvious. In any case, the Polish troopers once again drew their sabers and spurred their horses forward. The charge had started in a rather neat formation, a column four abreast, with the men advancing by platoon, each platoon led by its lieutenant. Now, the situation was so desperate and there were so many casualties that there was no use bothering with formations. Phase two of the charge was more of a mad dash. Squadron leader Jan Kosciuszko was going at a full gallop when his horse was shot from under him, collapsing immediately, before Kosciuszko could get out of the saddle. One of his legs was crushed under his mount's weight. He was eventually able to free himself from under the dead horse and actually began hobbling after his men, dragging his grotesque, shattered leg behind him. But practically speaking, he was out of the fight. But by now, the charge had gained such momentum that the Poles probably could not have stopped even if they had wanted to. Indeed, apparently some of the men had lost control of their horses, who were now galloping forward out of sheer instinct. Captain Jan Jevanovski took over command and led the remains of the squadron into the second battery. Once again, most of the Spanish militia panicked and fled, but once again the gunners picked up weapons and fought tenaciously. But once the horsemen were among the cannons, any further resistance was hopeless. The gunners were cut down. A Polish officer would later remember, quote, "The squadron had swept on uphill with cries of 'Forward!' and 'Long live the Emperor!' There were no other commands. No others were needed. All of us, whether captains, lieutenants, or troopers, burned with the same fervor, shouted the same words, and paid no attention either to the absence of Kosciuszko or to the fallen and still falling officers and comrades." End quote. By now, the Poles were committed. By the time the cannons of the 3rd Spanish Battery opened up on them, the horsemen were already galloping onwards. They were lucky that by now the narrow confines of the pass were thick with smoke, and that, out of instinct, the riderless horses of fallen troopers continued to gallop alongside the remains of the squadron. The Patriots might have stood firmer if they knew how few of the cavalrymen were left alive. Still, the Spanish grapeshot took a terrible toll. The squadron's new commander, Captain Jevanovski, had both an arm and leg shot through and fell from the saddle. Either the fall or the wound knocked him unconscious. Other sources say he was hit in the leg by a cannonball. In any case, Jevanovski, too, was out of the fight and would die of his wounds a few days later. Now, command passed to Captain Piotr Kraszynski, who began trying to reform the squadron, but was almost immediately hit in the chest by a piece of shrapnel. He too fell from the saddle and quickly lost consciousness, although he would ultimately survive. There was now only one officer in the squadron left alive and mounted. The most junior officer in the squadron, Lieutenant Andrzej Niegielewski, who had just celebrated his 21st birthday. Despite another round of horrific casualties, the 3rd battery was overwhelmed just like the first two. By this point, there were probably fewer than 50 troopers still alive, unhurt, and mounted. Lieutenant Niegielewski turned to one of his sergeants and asked, quote, "Where are our boys?" End quote. The sergeant replied, quote, "All killed," end quote. Only the last enemy battery remained. However, it was by far the most formidable, about twice the size of the other three batteries, and positioned at the crest of a hill. By now, news of this incredible feat had reached French headquarters. Napoleon immediately sent in reinforcements, another squadron from the 1st Polish Light Cavalry, plus several squadrons of French cavalry. Other French units closer to the front lines had recognized the significance of the charge and entered the pass under their own initiative. However, by the time the Poles took the 3rd Battery, none of these units had arrived, and the Poles were now taking fire from the 4th Battery. Once again, they had no choice but to fall back and give up everything they had won, or to gallop into the mouths of the cannon a fourth time. Nieglewski ordered the attack. That group of less than 50 men must have felt very small as they approached the 4th Battery. A Polish sergeant would later recall, quote, "Up until that moment, I had never understood what this hail of bullets, which veterans sometimes talked of, really meant. But from the moment I entered this hellish ravine, I quickly realized just what it was like. It wasn't a battlefield, but true hell. It seemed to me that the ground was burning. When I looked around, I couldn't see anyone. I just felt my horse galloping along and guessed that I had outpaced my comrades." End quote. Once again, 3rd Squadron came under heavy fire, and once again suffered terrible casualties. But, against all odds, they closed the distance and engaged the Patriot defenders. Once again, most of the militia did not have the stomach for a fight, and took off running. However, this was a large battery, and there were a lot more gunners here, and by now, the Poles were down to only a few dozen troopers. The fighting was intense, and it was not clear which side would gain the upper hand. Lieutenant Nieglewski's horse was hit, and he went down. Someone slashed him with a saber, and he was quickly surrounded by Patriot militia, who thrust their bayonets into him again and again. It looked like a tragic end for the men of 3rd Squadron. They had certainly not been lacking in bravery or toughness, but there might not have been enough of them to win this fight. But just when it seemed the tide was finally turning against the Poles, fresh hoofbeats could be heard from the rear. Those reinforcements were finally arriving. The position was taken. The pass now belonged to the French. Meanwhile, up on the heights, word had spread among the Spanish infantry that Imperial horsemen were riding through the pass. That meant the whole position was compromised. There might soon be French troops in the rear. They had no choice but to retreat. Some men simply ran, others fell back in good order. No matter how formidable those mountains might have been, there was no point in trying to hold on to them now that the French controlled the pass. That tough Patriot line that had held firm all morning simply evaporated. It was all over. A single squadron of cavalry had practically won the battle single-handedly. That morning, any educated observer would have predicted a hard, bloody fight. The way things worked out, Napoleon's forces had only suffered about 300 casualties, and the fighting was over by about noon. The sacrifice of the Polish squadron had probably saved hundreds or even thousands of men from death or injury. However, within the narrow confines of the pass, it probably didn't look like it had been a bloodless victory. The whole area was littered with dead and wounded men and horses, discarded weapons, and the cannons the Patriot gun crews had fought so hard to defend. While the French army as a whole had achieved a relatively bloodless victory, 3rd Squadron of the Polish Light Cavalry of the Imperial Guard had paid a terrible price. Around half had become casualties. The recently fired Marshal Bessières walked over the battlefield, surveying the carnage. He encountered Lieutenant Nieglewski, that young officer who had taken over command in the final phase of the charge. He was covered in blood from a large saber wound and perhaps as many as 10 bayonet wounds. Miraculously, he was still alive. Bessières tried to comfort him. Quote, "Young man, the Emperor has seen the beautiful charge of the light cavalry. He will know how to appreciate your bravery." End quote. Nieglewski replied, no doubt with great effort, quote, "My lord, I am dying. Here are the cannon that I took. Tell that to the Emperor." End quote. Despite the carnage, the mood in the French ranks was jubilant. As they walked into the pass, the Voltigeurs sang the old revolutionary anthem, Ça Ira. Some of them lifted the surviving Polish troopers up on their shoulders and carried them through the pass, cheering. The men of the French infantry knew that had the charge failed, many of them surely would have been killed or wounded in the subsequent fighting. Almost as soon as the battle died down, Napoleon himself rode into the pass. He was beaming. As he moved through the battlefield, he repeated to every Polish trooper he encountered, quote, "You are brave Poles," end quote, and, quote, "You are my bravest cavalry," end quote. When the emperor reached the other end of the pass, he too encountered young Lieutenant Niegolevsky, still alive, but fading in and out of consciousness. When he was informed this was the young man who had led the final phase of the charge, the emperor took the Medal of the Legion of Honor from his own chest and pinned it on Niegolevsky. Shortly after the emperor left, one of Niegolevsky's friends recognized him under all the blood, a lieutenant of the Grenadiers of the Imperial Guard named Villeneuve. Villeneuve forced him to drink a few sips of rum to ease the pain, telling him, quote, "Poor devil, you've had it. No more fun for you," end quote. Villeneuve had been on a lot of campaigns and had seen a lot of wounded soldiers. He didn't think Niegolevsky would survive, or at the very least, he would never be able to return to service. But he was wrong. Amazingly, Niegolevsky would be back in the saddle less than a year later. He fought all the way through the rest of the Napoleonic Wars, and in the ultimately unsuccessful November Uprising against the Russians in 1830. In middle age, he would be elected to the Polish Parliament. He died at the ripe old age of 69, apparently suffering no long-term effects from his horrible wounds. Meanwhile, the Spanish retreat had turned into a rout. The remains of the French cavalry pursued them doggedly for 8 kilometers, or 5 miles, causing more casualties, netting hundreds of prisoners, and capturing valuable supplies and equipment. The Battle of Somosierra had been a complete disaster for the Spanish. They lost somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 men, compared to only about 300 French casualties. Losses among 3rd Squadron, 1st Polish Light Cavalry of the Imperial Guard, were 57 killed or wounded, probably just under 50% of the men who took part. All 8 of the officers who had led the charge were either killed or wounded. Those are staggering numbers, but not quite as bad as you might expect from that narrative. That's because a significant number of troopers, probably at least a few dozen, were knocked from their horses at some point during the charge. They were unable to continue all the way to the end, but were not badly hurt enough to report themselves wounded. When Niegolevsky's sergeant told him all their boys were dead, he was actually probably wrong. At least a few of them were further back in the pass, unable to continue because they had no mounts. The casualty numbers barely begin to tell the story of how badly this defeat stung for the Patriots. General San Juan's improvised army had been completely shattered. They had lost a lot in their disorganized retreat from the battlefield. All the artillery, 10 regimental standards, and nearly all the army's supplies and baggage. Worse, there was no longer any major geographic barrier between Bonaparte and the capital, and no significant body of Patriot troops that might oppose him. The heroism of 3rd Squadron had destroyed their last chance of stopping Napoleon. French troops entered Madrid on December 4, 1808. They found the Supreme Junta had already fled to the comparative safety of Seville, in southern Spain. Still, the city was by far the biggest prize in the country, and it was now back in French hands. King José Bonaparte could retake his throne. When news of the fall of the capital reached the remains of General San Juan's army, it seems to have completely destroyed that spirit of crusading patriotism that animated the volunteers. A few stayed, but many deserted. Rather than simply going home, some turned bandit and began looting and terrorizing nearby towns and religious institutions. On the night of January 7th, 1809, one of these groups of wayward Spanish deserters attacked an Augustinian convent in the town of Talavera, where General San Juan was staying. The general tried to reason with them, but when he saw they were unmoved, he made a break for it. He was halfway out a window when the deserters opened fire. General Don Benito de San Juan went down in a hail of bullets. Before this campaign started, Napoleon told his brother he wanted it to be over before the new year, leaving less than 2 months to defeat the Spanish armies and seize the capital. In the end, he finished with almost a month to spare. The Battle of Somosierra has gone down in Polish history as one of the country's great military achievements. It's one of those names the public knows, in the same way Americans have heard of Bunker Hill or Gettysburg, or Englishmen have heard of Agincourt or Dunkirk. In Poland, Somosierra is invoked with solemn reverence. It represents bravery, sacrifice, and patriotism. Back in early 1809, when news of the battle first reached Poland, there were also more complicated feelings. Many were horrified by the high casualties. The 1st Polish Light Cavalry of the Imperial Guard was an elite unit, in more ways than one. The officers, and even many of the troopers, were drawn from Poland's most eminent families, aristocrats, minor gentry, and wealthy townspeople. This was almost like a medieval battle, in which many knights had been killed. The ruling classes felt the losses of that day much stronger than the country at large. However, generally speaking, Poland was proud that its soldiers had taken center stage. As I've tried to remind you throughout the course of this show, the Poles have been a part of this story since almost the very beginning. As you might remember from our very first episodes, the European geopolitical situation at the outbreak of the French Revolution was largely shaped by dramatic events going on in Poland. Regiments of Polish exiles began appearing in the French ranks in the very first war we covered on this show, the War of the First Coalition. In fact, the Poles joined the fight before Bonaparte did. When Napoleon took command of the Army of Italy, it contained a significant Polish contingent, and he had Polish officers on his staff as well. Polish troops had not only fought in Italy, but in Germany, Egypt, Haiti, basically everywhere the French had fought over the course of these wars, there had been Polish comrades by their side. The Polish legions had served France well, and now that the Grand Duchy of Warsaw had come into being, it was one of Napoleon's most important allies. But Somosierra is the first time we've really seen the Polish forces take center stage. They had made a lot of contributions, and had seen a lot of hard fighting, but this is the first time we can really conclusively say the Poles won the battle. Under the circumstances, it's easy to see why Somosierra has taken on this almost mythic significance in the Polish national consciousness. Sadly, and somewhat strangely, until very recently, the true story of the battle was not well known outside Poland. As is sometimes the case, almost as soon as news of this victory began to spread, others began trying to take credit. The most egregious offender was General Philippe Paul de Segur. Segur was a celebrated general within the Grande Armée, but more importantly, after the war, he became a very well-known writer and memoirist. His version of events was widely seen as authoritative, and he claimed to have led the charge himself, acknowledging that most of the troopers were Polish, but making it into more of a French story, and most of all, casting himself as the hero. Other French authors gave the credit to General Monbrun, the overall commander of the Imperial Guard cavalry. Apparently, Monbrun himself laughed at this, but that didn't stop this version of the story from being repeated by scholars. You can even find accounts of the battle that claim the Polish charge failed, and it was only a second charge, led by the Frenchmen of the Chasseurs of the Imperial Guard, which took the pass. There is sort of a grain of truth there. The Chasseurs of the Guard were one of the units who reinforced the Poles, and there is some doubt as to when exactly they arrived, but it was definitely at the end of the charge, either just as the Poles were approaching the final battery or after they had already attacked it. Basically, every modern scholar rejects the idea that the chasseurs took the pass, but I've seen it repeated in books that were written as recently as the 1960s. Part of the problem here is Napoleon himself. The imperial bulletin released after the battle is somewhat ambiguous, and does not actually name any of the Polish officers who led the charge, creating an ambiguity in the narrative that could be exploited by those who wanted to present this as a French affair. It's all a bit bizarre because, as you may have noticed from all the quotations in this episode, many of the surviving officers and troopers of 3rd Squadron wrote down their recollections of the battle, some of which are very detailed and quite specific. There is some confusion over some minor points and the exact sequence of events, in particular the timing of those reinforcements who arrived to help take the final battery. But there now seems to be consensus that the charge was carried out almost entirely by that single squadron of the 1st Polish Light Cavalry of the Imperial Guard, as recounted by the men who were actually there, and as I've tried to present to you in this episode. I don't know why it took so long for the truth of this battle to emerge. Perhaps it's simply the fact that very few Western scholars speak Polish. Whatever the case, based on what I've seen, the newer the book, the likelier it is to get this story right, to rely on the accounts of the men who took part in the charge, rather than secondhand accounts or the tall tales of glory hounds. The men of 3rd Squadron, 1st Polish Light Cavalry of the Imperial Guard, are finally getting their due, and joining the pantheon of Napoleonic heroes. There is, of course, an alternative view to this story. Poland's glory was Spain's disaster. It wasn't just the Battle of Somosierra. November 1808 had been one of the darkest months in Spanish history. No fewer than 5 armies smashed, several completely destroyed. Thousands of men killed, wounded, or captured, including many regulars from the old Royal Army, who the government was in no position to replace anytime soon. The capital, with its strategic position and all its resources, was back in French hands. And imagine what a moral blow this was. Madrid was not only the capital, it had been the cradle of the Spanish resistance. Only a few weeks earlier, the Spanish had been preparing to go on the offensive, hoping to push the French out of the last small area of Spanish territory they still controlled. Many Spaniards believed their cause was a holy crusade, sanctioned by God, whose support had allowed them to achieve so much surprising success in the early phase of the war. November 1808 had been a very rude awakening. Even the most optimistic Spanish patriot would have to admit their country would have to face many painful trials before that goal would be in reach once again. This was one of the great tragedies of the Napoleonic Wars. The Poles didn't value their freedom any less than the Spanish. In fact, in many ways, they were fighting for similar causes. But the vagaries of European geopolitics had put those causes in direct opposition. Over 10 years earlier, the great Polish poet and political leader Józef Wybicki was in Italy with troops from the Polish legions. He wrote a poem inspired by his experiences, expressing the hope of the Polish patriots. Quote, "Poland has not yet died, so long as we still live. What foreign powers have seized from us, we shall recapture with a saber. March, March Dombrowski, to Poland from the Italian lands. Under your command, we shall rejoin the nation. We'll cross the Vistula, we'll cross the Warta, we shall be Polish. Bonaparte has given us the example of how we should prevail." End quote. In the subsequent 10 years, those hopes had been realized, much as Wybicki had envisioned. Now, Poland's soldiers were still fighting, sword in hand, to defend that dream. I think on November 30th, 1808, they showed Bonaparte they had learned well. Before we go, I'd like to mention a book that was a huge help in writing this episode. Samosiera, 1808, The Legendary Charge of Napoleon's Polish Guard Cavalry, by Jonathan North and Marek Tadeusz Wołowski. And, on a more general note, as I mentioned earlier in this episode, there are a lot of unreliable retellings of this battle out there. If you're looking for more information about Samosiera, keep your eye out for accounts that quote the actual participants. Those tend to be the most reliable. Anyway, that's all for now. We'll close out today with the musical version of Wybicki's poem, which has since become Poland's national anthem. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections oder Excel-Superkräfte?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Ich fühle mich plötzlich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Abgabefrist 31. Juli.
Was?
Schaffst du ganz entspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
Ach, ja.